The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, you just came out of a CNN interview discussing the housing numbers. Could you restate some of the things that you talked to CNN about this morning?
Hey, Kevin, it was interesting because at the end of the conversation, it came down to this. So you're telling me, Dave, that my home is not going to be back to where it once was here in the next few months or years? And I just had to say, unfortunately, it's not. And, you know, as I look at the housing market, there's similarities between the housing market, the U.S. debt market, and what we see in Europe. These three have a common theme. They're structurally impaired. There's not small details that you can tweak here and there and make it better. This is a major issue that's going to take years, if not decades, to really get ahead of. And on the housing issue, I mean, the topic of conversation was new home sales, which are about a fifth of the total each year. Right. And this last year was the fifth year in a row of declines since the recession ended 2 years ago, in quotes, of course. The sales of new homes have fallen an extra 18%. So, you know, we're in recovery, and yet the primary asset for the average American is still in free fall. Kevin, it's interesting because you look at these new home sales numbers, and again, they're less important than the existing home sales numbers, but if you look at how the data goes back to 1963.
Right.
We are at present numbers 20% below anything that we've seen since 1963. And that has a lot to do with what happened between 1990 and 2005. This was a period, again, if you're looking at that chart, it's unbelievable. It's the kind of growth that you see, well, frankly, we saw it in the stock market in the same period of time.
Well, you know,
easy
David,
money equals assets going through the roof.
You know, the thing is, with the increase in the price of real estate through those years that you were mentioning, I just read something that talked about U.S. household income, and did it keep up with the housing prices? And, you know, this is an interesting contrast to what you're talking about, home prices falling, but only the top 5% of U.S. households have earned enough additional income to match the rise in housing costs since 1975. So, in a way, there is a recorrection or maybe an equalization that's occurring, going back and matching this income that never did keep up.
Yeah, and another question we talked about was an issue with foreclosures, if that was a concern. And it's expected to see this year's numbers come in at about 1.2 million in terms of foreclosed homes. Now, I think it's going to end up being higher than that, Kevin, because we've got on banks balance sheets. This is sort of a shadow inventory of foreclosed homes that are not being marketed actively today. In addition to the 1.2 million expected, as much as another 1.7 million in shadow inventory. And that does not include over 5 million that are 90 days late or in some form delinquent mortgages, which we think to some degree will end up feeding that foreclosure pipeline.
Well, and keep in mind, those foreclosures are the competition for every good citizen out there who just needs to sell his house, maybe to relocate, get another job. They're the competition, and the foreclosures are in the millions.
The bright spot last week that we noted on our wealth management website was that home starts are picking up. This is the problem. Good news, bad news. Good news is there's a few more homes being built. Bad news is we've got such an overhang of supply.
It's just more inventory.
Why do we need more inventory? Yeah. And of course, if you're talking about KB or Toll Brothers or Beazer, or Ian, these guys have got to be getting to work. They've got to just to function as an organization. So yes, they will build. And so we do have a major, major inventory issue, both present and future tense.
Okay. Now, David, with the housing situation being what it is, that is a long-term, like you said, a structural problem. But in the short run, right now, all eyes are on Washington, D.C. and the Eurozone. I mean, let's face it, whether it's a real issue, whether it's a fake issue, whether it's an election issue, whether it's a default issue, and we can maybe cover that today, all eyes are glued to the television sets for, you know, Europe and D.C.
Well, and speaking of D.C., just before we move off the point on housing, because there is one bright spot in the real estate market.
I bet you it's Washington, D.C.
Exactly. The Case-Shiller 20-City Price Index that Case-Shiller puts together.
Right.
Their year-on-year decline announced this week was 4.5%. So again, we are talking about an oversupply of houses, and you're seeing that show up not just in inventory numbers, but in actual price numbers where, yes, that overhang is causing a decline in prices, with really one exception, and that exception is Washington, D.C.
I wonder why. I guess these guys' incomes come in anyway, whether other people have jobs or not.
The real issue, Kevin, is that we're seeing consumers deleverage, and we need to see some degree of deleveraging across the board. We'll talk about D.C., we'll talk about our debt issues here in the United States, we'll talk about Europe as well, but the consumer is no different. The consumer has made a small bit of progress. If you look at the work the St. Louis Fed has done on this point in recent months, Kevin, household debt as a percentage of income peaked in 2007, and it was 130% of income, okay. Household debt to income.
Right.
And with the deleveraging which has occurred, defaults, foreclosures, bankruptcies, et cetera, it's marginally improved. That number has declined from 130% of income to 117% of income. It's our suggestion that we probably get back to 2000 levels, where we'd see roughly a 90% number. A 90%, that's an additional $3 to $4 trillion worth of deleveraging in the mortgage and consumer debt areas, Kevin. And so, yes, we do see some deleveraging that has occurred. We think there will be more in the mortgage space, in the consumer space. The question we have revolves around U.S. debt and European debt, because obviously there's an overhang. There's too much in terms of supply of those types of debt, sovereign debt specifically. The question is, will we see deleveraging there?
Well, with what you were talking about on income, okay, right now the average American household is carrying $75,600 in debt, okay? And I saw these numbers come out. The median average wage in the United States is $26,000. It's $26,261. How in the world do you get just even the $75,000 worth of personal debt paid off, not to mention the trillions that we're talking about here with the government?
Yeah, and, you know, relative to Bangalore or Kuala Lumpur, $26,000 a year, that's a handsome sum.
Right.
But relative to those debt numbers, you're right. It's a pittance, and it's a long journey between paying current bills and paying off the past debts to get to break even. So it is a structural issue, Kevin. And, you know, it's in the face of declining asset prices and a burst credit bubble that we had the study that Reinhart and Rogoff put together. And it was in post-World War II events of this kind where they said basically government debt will grow an average of 86%. Now, here in the United States, we've only seen our government debt grow by 40%. So actually, the current debt crisis is very tame by comparison. But it's likely to continue, Kevin. It's likely to continue. And a part of the reason is we see these guys back in D.C., mental midgets who are not solving the problem at all. And this is one of the things that we want to address today.
Well, wouldn't you say there's a positive side to this, though? I mean, right now, for the first time in a long time, you've got Americans actually looking at and thinking about the long-term sustainability of the system. You know, if you would have talked to them just a couple of years ago, debt was an issue that, yeah, we have debt, we deficit spend, but that's just the way things go. At this point, for the first time, I think, in my lifetime, I'm seeing Americans actually take national debt and personal debt seriously.
Well, the question is, what are they being focused on? Because unfortunately, they are fixating on the issues that the news media and our politicians are directing them to.
Right.
The debt ceiling is a symptom, not a cause. Now, I think this is going to end up backfiring on everyone in D.C. because everyone, as you say, Kevin, is thinking about debt for the first time in a long time and not giving D.C. and the D.C.ites a free pass to spend and play with whatever sums they get in terms of the tax take. Kevin, the real cause, and again, the debt ceiling is just a symptom, the real cause is that we've got payola going back to constituency groups.
Right.
The job of politicians today is to bring home the pork.
It's pork spending. I mean, they say they cut it every single time there's an election. It's like, you know, we're going to cut all these pork spending projects. But in reality,
that's their job description.
They don't want to cut anything. In fact, it just came out yesterday that Harry Reid is now suggesting that they're going to be able to use the savings from the end of the Afghan war and just call that savings on this plan. Now, do we have a credibility gap here, Dave?
Well, this is the issue. And as you mentioned, we've got the whole world focusing on D.C. and the Eurozone for good reasons. Our hope is that they're focused on the right things, right, and are not satisfied with surface or superficial solutions. Do we have a growing credibility issue? You bet we do.
Sure.
Do we have a debt downgrade issue? You bet we do.
Let me ask you, Do we have a default issue, Dave?
We do not have a default issue at this point. The downgrade issue, Kevin, was in the pipeline long before the wrangling has occurred over this debt ceiling issue.
So do you think default's being used as a big bet that's actually an imaginary bet right now?
I think it is, and we'll talk about that in just a minute. Because, Kevin, again, you look at the details of each proposal, whether it's the Democrats or the Republicans, and you can begin to see a strategy emerging on both sides. The Republicans are playing for a solution that leaves economic and fiscal issues an utter tangled mess in this upcoming election.
So 2012.
Yeah, notice the dates. Notice the dates of any of the Republican proposals. It leaves a quagmire still to be solved before the 2012 election, giving them leverage and an advantage coming into the election. Temporary solutions with issues still to be addressed in 2012. Democrats on the other side are pushing for solutions with the 2013 cure.
Sure, let's don't deal with this until after we are re-elected.
And what they're saying is we don't want a temporary solution. We want a big picture solution. Balderdash, they don't want a real solution. They want to buy time until they get past. They want there to be a solution. They want to be the hero and not really do anything at all, not address it until 2013.
So, David, I mean, other than the politics that we all know is going on, including the politician, they almost look at each other with a wink, wink, nod, nod, you know, that this is all politics. The debt ceiling itself really is not the issue, is what you're saying. You've been saying this now for a long time, but I want to hear you say it's not the issue and why, because we're getting a lot of questions right now from our listeners about the very thing that we're seeing in the news.
I talked to a number of people this last week who said, I'm really concerned about August 2nd.
Right.
This is what you call a straw man. This is what you call a diversion. It's our long-term fiscal position, which is desperately upside down.
Well, explain that, because it's so much larger. This issue that we're watching on TV,
yeah,
right now.
We have a $77 trillion funding gap.
That $77 million funding gap. That's amazing.
Well, and this is the problem. Everyone's talking about cutting the budget by 1.2 over the next 10 years, 3 trillion over the next 2 years. They don't get it.
Yeah, it's like what we talked about last week, Dave. It's meaningless in the scheme of things.
Or they do get it. And they know that it's so terrifying that it cannot be brought into the conversation because there is no real solution that will not cost them their political legacy. And that's, I think, what everyone wants to ensure. It won't happen on their watch. So if we can buy time, if we can kick the can down the road, they will do that. Debt ceiling's not the issue. It's a $77 trillion funding gap. It is our fiscal position, which is desperately upside down. Again, it's a structural issue. It's a structural issue.
All right, now I'm going to ask you to move over the Atlantic just for a moment, okay? Because what we saw over the last couple of weeks is something similar to what we're seeing here in the United States, when reality is Greece was not the issue. There's a much larger issue. You know, we interviewed Otmar Issing last year, and he was probably one of the key, if not the key, backbone supports of the euro coming in. You know, he was head of the European Central Bank for 7 years. And at this point, Otmar Issing is struggling to see the euro survive, or explain what he's been saying.
Well, recently, just this, the present seemingly unstoppable process toward further financial transfers will generate tensions of an economic and especially political kind.
Right.
The longer this process is characterized by unsound conduct of individual member countries, the more these tensions will endanger the existence of the EMU. He's looking at it and saying, basically, you allow for a Greek default and allow them to maintain a position in the EMU, and you've compromised the integrity of the whole EMU project.
Well, he knows that Portugal comes next, and then maybe Spain, and then maybe Italy and Ireland. What we've been talking about before, they have a lot of dead weight right now, just like we have dead weight on this side, and it's not being addressed, it's just being bandaged.
Right. Well, and this comes back to the issue of a downgrade or a default.
Okay.
And everything that's being bandied about here as a real concern, our concern, is that people are being utterly misled. Kevin, a default occurs in the instance, like we've just seen in Greece, where we're talking about a missed payment, where interest and principal cannot be made, and because of that, that debt has to be restructured. Those are forms of default, okay? So what do we have here with this debt ceiling here in the United States that is anything remotely like that?
Right.
Not raising the debt ceiling does not mandate a U.S. debt default. It simply means that the U.S. government must prioritize payments. Was there any question that we live in a welfare state? Was there any question that we live in a welfare state? The problem here is that the Democrats are up against making a very tough choice. Who gets paid and who doesn't?
Well, and that I'm going to bring that up because entitlements, and, you know, granted, they pointed the gun right at the older people and said, you know, Social Security might be, you know, jeopardized and we may, if we don't raise the debt ceiling. But in reality, those are entitlements that if they don't get paid, what actually would be, you know, granted, we don't want to see Social Security recipients not get their Social Security, but actually what triggers on paper when they don't pay?
This is, I think, what we're talking about, Kevin. There's obligations, and we're using words very loosely in the press these days.
Right.
But to have a financial obligation in the form of Social Security, Medicare, or Medicaid, yes, you have put yourself on the hook for those payments. But that is different than having something as a contract, in a formal IOU, say, for instance, with the Japanese, the Chinese, or folks who are holding T-bills, T-bonds, and T-notes in the Middle East or Europe.
Right.
That is a formal obligation that requires principal and interest repayments. If you miss payments of principal and interest, then you are in default. You are in breach of contract, essentially. You may have a similar breach of contract with a Social Security recipient, but that is not a form of default. That is simply you not being able to make payment to your constituency.
That's you making your constituency very, very mad,
very
scared, maybe very hungry, but it doesn't trigger a default issue. And I think this is a critical point right now, David, for people to understand, because they're discussing this with others, they're watching it on the news, and they're being manipulated by the politicians.
Utterly manipulated.
A default triggers a huge, huge problem. We've got credit default swaps not just over in Europe, but we have credit default swaps that would trigger here. We've got a lot of funds that would have to liquidate U.S. treasuries if they were downgraded. I mean, there's a ton of things. It's a chain reaction if there was a default. But what you're saying is it ain't a default.
No, we're just talking about certain entitled entities not getting what they've been promised.
Right.
That's the bigger issue. The bigger issue, Kevin, is every month the federal government has to send out 88 million checks. Okay. 88 million checks.
This is the entitlement.
If you want to do the math on that, just the postage to get those out on an annual basis is about $465 million.
Just for the stamp.
Just for the postage to deliver, just to get those checks to you. I think that we've got much bigger issues than raising the debt ceiling. If someone at this point wants to posture around not raising it on the basis of principle, I would ask them, where were you last year, the year before, the decade before? This is 30 to 40 years of a work in process. There is no way you can whitewash your career as a politician at this point and maintain credibility. Let's be honest.
Let's go ahead and talk about the markets then, because, yes, let's say our listeners say, yeah, you're right. This is all just, you know, it's smoke and mirrors. This is a lot of politics that's going on. Our investors still have investments in gold. They have investments in dollars. They have investments maybe in the stock market. They are affected. Okay, whether this is smoke and mirrors or not, David, I mean, what happens to the dollar if there was a downgrade?
Well, there's further pressure, a major pressure on the dollar.
Well,
in
the dollar,
downgrade.
The dollar right now is at an all-time low against the franc, I believe. And gold is at an all-time high or in that range.
Exactly.
So it is, the markets are speaking at this point.
And you've got Citigroup now seeing a 50% chance of a downgrade this year. I mean, I think the idea of a downgrade, it was going to happen. The debt ceiling debate has just brought more attention to the fact that we've got solvency issues here in the United States. Not just liquidity issues, but solvency issues. Real structural issues where we have deficient payments coming in terms of tax revenues and excessive payments going out in terms of entitlement spending.
All right.
We have to look at the impact of what happens in the next few weeks or months as the market makes its votes. What happens in the event of a downgrade? We definitely see the dollar take it on the chin and gold gets another bit higher. If, on the other hand, they come up with a solution,
which you know they probably will.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, this is the straw man problem, which they will solve to some degree. What happens to the dollar? Well, now we don't have the reasons for there to be pressure on the dollar, quote unquote, they will say. And so we're likely to see a short snap higher for the dollar.
A mini rally in the dollar.
Mini rally in the dollar.
Maybe
because
you could see gold adjust down a little bit.
Absolutely. Maybe you give up 50, 60, 70 bucks on the gold price.
Okay.
Very temporary in nature, Kevin, because again, we haven't addressed any of the structural issues. This is what we've witnessed for the last 2 years in Europe. They've come up with band-aid solutions, provided more liquidity, and added debt to other layers of debt, pretending that that was a solution, and ultimately it's leading to an insolvency endgame.
Once again, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com. David, I just read something on a blog, and I think this guy hit it right on the head. He said, raising the debt ceiling to solve the deficit problem is a little like raising the blood alcohol limit to solve drunk driving. It just don't do it. Okay.
That's right. That's right. So, I mean, that's what we've continued to do, Kevin, is put Band-Aid solutions, something that on the surface appears to solve it, but structurally doesn't change anything. In fact, raise the level in terms of blood alcohol content, and you're going to find a lot more people driving drunk.
Well, talk about dancing through a china closet, okay? The European solution has four elements that you talked about in the McIlvaney Weekly Recap last Friday. By the way, that can be found online at the McIlvaney Wealth website. You can go to McIlvaney.com and continue to navigate. But every Friday, if you want to read a brief summary of the markets and the thoughts of David McIlvaney and David Burgess over at McIlvaney Wealth Management, that recap is a great recap. But David, if you would, restate what that Greek bailout plan was, you know, the four elements of how they were able to dance through calling it a default, because in reality, these guys really are defaulting, but they're calling it something different by restructuring the way they pay.
Right. I think the two critical things from last week, as they pertain to Europe, were we saw a default with Greece, and we saw a new architecture for bailout. And, you know, this is what Sarkozy was calling the EMF.
Okay.
Instead of the IMF and the International Monetary Fund there to sort of patch everything up, Europe's becoming more independent. I've read some great analysis on that, Kevin, that says, you know, this is a step forward for Europe in terms of gaining autonomy and distancing itself from a dollar-centric and Anglo-centric. Great, fine. If you want to think that, think that.
They're going to miss us because we are the IMF.
We still are a major component of the bailout.
They need our dollars.
Right. But the reality is, even the funds that they're using, Kevin, this is the EFSF fund that they put together a number of months ago,
right.
$400 billion and change. It's not the right size. It's enough to solve the Greek issue because that's about how much Greek debt there is, but it's not enough to solve the Spanish issue on its own. It's not enough to stand any pressure in the Italian markets, which, by the way, did you see the Italians cancel their bond offering last week? They're looking at penalty rates, and they just decided, oh, actually, we have plenty of liquidity. We don't need to float this bond issue. So they went forward with a bill issue, but the longer-dated bond issue, which is catching major pressure as interest rates increase, as people are saying to themselves, there's a problem with Italian debt. They just said, we don't need the money.
We've got plenty in the bank. Pay too much for it. That's exactly right.
Exactly.
Interest rates rose on them, and it hurts.
It does hurt.
So go ahead. Tell us how they restructured it so that they could call a default something other than a default.
Kevin, it's not a default, in their opinion, because it's freely chosen. And so they've been given sort of this menu of options. You can wait and see what happens, and you may get paid on time with all of your investment dollars.
That's number one.
So if that's option number one, Kevin, certainly you can sit there, scratch your chin, and wonder, will this actually occur? Will I see some return of value? Just a par or some portion of it. Or option number two is extend your maturities to 30 years,
right,
and accept a 4.5% coupon with a principal guarantee component.
Okay.
What's interesting about that, Kevin, it's buying time.
Right.
Now, what it's not guaranteeing is what the value of the currency is over this 30-year period.
Sure.
We guarantee the principal. We just can't guarantee what the euro is worth at the end of 30 years.
Well, look at the dollar. It's lost 90% of its value in the last 30 years.
I love it. Now, I mean, it's the greatest scam on earth. Insurance companies do this all the time. They say, you know, we'll insure you for $1 million. 30 years from now, they'll pay on it, and guess what it's worth?
Yeah.
They got a present tense value, Kevin, and you got suckered into being played as a fool on the game which favors the house because of one component, and that one component is
the devaluation of the currency.
That's right.
Yeah.
Inflation over a longer period of time. The third option is extend maturities to 30 years.
Like the last one.
Yep. Discount those bonds by 20% and receive a higher coupon payment. Instead of 4.5%, they bump you to 6.42%. And also, there's a principal guarantee. So you're taking a little bit of a haircut, which, again, you look at sitting on a 40 to 50% haircut at present because that's what's happened in the marketplace, and you say, wait a minute. I only have to take a 20% haircut? That means you're giving me principal back. If I had to trade these bonds in the open market, I'd get skinned alive. And you're going to give me some of that back? That's a no-brainer. The fourth option is extend not to 30, but extend to 15 years. Again, take the same 20% haircut, receive 5.9%, and get a partial guarantee of principal. Kevin, and what they're trying to do is make these offerings so attractive that everyone comes to them, chooses from the menu on a voluntary basis, and on that basis, they don't trigger a credit default swap, a payment in the credit default swap market as a result of default.
Well, and we've covered these credit default swaps for a long time, especially since 2008 when we started to see the Lehman problem, you know, come apart. But that credit default swap issue is so important to understand because, David, they are calling this something other than, you said they're just expecting people to come running up to the window and say, yeah, I'll go ahead and let you extend my bond, and yeah, I don't mind if you don't pay me for 30 years. But in reality, they have defaulted. Now, are we going to see these credit default swaps at this point trigger?
I think, Kevin, this is the beauty of contract law. You could have this mired in the courts for years, and you could have the parties who bought the insurance saying, hey, wait a minute, you defaulted. You owe me cash.
Right.
That's why I had the insurance. It's supposed to pay in the event of a default. You're not paying? This is breach of contract. So now you've got an interested party who is expecting payment as a result of a CDS trigger saying, where's my dough? And so they take it to the court to defend their claim. How long does it take to sort this out, Kevin? I have no idea.
Well,
no one does.
Dave, the bottom line is these credit default swaps, they're not all just sold to bad guys, okay? They're sold to all of our portfolios. I mean, insurance companies buy them, banks buy them. We talked about this last week. And so if there's a default and there is a change in the payment method for the structure of what's in my portfolio, say at the insurance company that I'm at, then that loss has been socialized worldwide if they don't call it a default.
This is the classic idea that Walter Baggio wrote about in Great Britain. You know, where in an event like this, you lend at a penalty rate and against good collateral. Now we're talking about garbage collateral, and that's no penalty rate.
Right.
4.5%, you're actually giving a free pass, which means that someone is subsidizing the rate somewhere. And that's exactly what we've seen happen here in the United States as well. We have a low interest rate environment, an artificially suppressed interest rate environment, and the subsidy to the bank balance sheet is coming from you, the depositor. So it's not as if low interest rates just represent cheap money. It's not that at all. It is a redistribution of capital from the depositor to the banker. In this case, you are rebuilding the Greek balance sheet
right.
through an artificially suppressed interest rate. So, yes, it's not exactly fair. It is utterly a socialized risk, and it's something that we don't think represents a normal market functioning. Kevin, what we thought was particularly fascinating this last week was as the EU ministers were patting themselves on the back for a job well done, for having averted a crisis, for, in their opinion, and having averted a default, even though technically they triggered one,
right.
the price of gold kept on marching higher. And it was just a siren saying, you're fools. You're all fools. You don't get it. Nothing's changed. The structural impairment is still there. You still have the debts to pay. In fact, if you look, Kevin, at what they accomplished, the debt to GDP figures in Greece, guess how much they improved? They went from roughly 156% of GDP to 140% of GDP.
Wow.
Going back to Reinhardt and Rogoff, yeah. This is the same issue. If you're above 90%, you're up the wrong creek without a paddle.
You know, David, throughout history, gold has always told the truth. And this is where politicians have always hated gold. We talked that last week. The statists have always hated it because they have to lie to their constituency about debt. They have to lie about a number of things.
But it's a plumb line against which they are measured, and they are found today all askew. They're found bent and broken and going the wrong direction, whereas gold is charting a very accurate course. The only way forward is towards solvency, and these are hard choices that you have to make.
All right. Now, David, I want to broaden the picture a little bit because Ronald Reagan, you know, we go back to Ronald Reagan and some of these people who we look at and, you know, we admire a lot of their decisions that they made. You know, under the Reagan administration, we did see the fall of the, quote, evil empire. But the behind-the-scenes moves that it took actually tripled our debt. You know, under Ronald Reagan, we went from $1 trillion in debt, which it took us from George Washington all the way to Jimmy Carter to get to. And yet, in Ronald Reagan's first watch, they had to triple the debt because it looked like we were going into a recession and he may not get reelected, and he had a plan, and that plan had to do with getting rid of this Cold War expense and danger.
Kevin, I think this is where Laffer gets too much credit, because yes, we accumulated the debt, and yes, things did recover, and yes, this apparently did work, but it was the circumstances which made it possible. You can't just willy-nilly add debt and have that be a solution to your problem. We added it then to a very pristine balance sheet. You may not like $1 trillion in debt, but we had a growing economy nonetheless, right. And you know, we could actually afford to do it. It ended up being productive debt, you could say. The debt that's been acquired, this last bump of 40%, and likely, you know, again, as Reinhardt and Rogoff have said, classically, in a credit bust like this, you'll see government debt go up as much as 86% from its original baseline. Kevin, it's non-productive at this point.
Right.
It's non-productive. We're not getting any GDP growth for every dollar in debt that we're acquiring, whereas we used to get almost dollar for dollar GDP growth. Now it's a fraction of that.
Well, Dave, and that's my point. Okay, in the beginning, you've got these men. I asked you this the other day. I said, let's just pretend for a moment that in this corner, sitting here at the table with us, is Ronald Reagan. Let's pretend like Ronald Reagan is sitting here right now, and he sees what's happening right now. Even though they made that behind closed doors decision in 1983 to triple the debt using Japanese money. Okay, Ronald Reagan had a mission and a reason for it, but it kept going out of control. But in the other corner, Otmar Issing. This was an older man who you spoke with last year, who had a dream of keeping Europe out of a third world war. It seemed that Europe continued to fall into war because there was no unity. He saw monetary unity as a way to keep this from happening. And, you know, just yesterday, now he's starting to say, wait a second, this may not work. So are we seeing old men's dreams gone horribly wrong at this point? And it's turned to old men's disappointments.
Well, you can see, Kevin, that those two men that you mentioned made an existential commitment. I mean, we had the threat of the Cold War, we had the threat of the Soviet Union, we had the threat of the Great Bear, and that certainly was an emotional motivator for any and all means in terms of defense of freedom in the free world.
Right, and it may have warranted debt under Ronald Reagan's administration at the time.
Those were certainly the avenues of logic that Reagan pursued, and we have Otmar Issing on the other side, who reflected with us that his father was a part of the German regime,
yeah.
And he sat with another banking administrator of the ECB.
Who was a Frenchman,
whose father was on the other side.
Yeah.
And they realized existentially that there was right and wrong, and that they wanted a better world. They wanted a better place for their children. They wanted a better place for their grandchildren. Their commitment to the ECB was not one of a socialist leviathan, but one in which there was an insurance policy, an insurance where we are so connected that we can't possibly hurt each other without hurting ourselves.
Right.
And you got that sense of, yes, we had to give it a shot because we discovered what men can do. And unfortunately, it's a very ugly, evil thing. My wife and I did some studying and reading on Nanking in 1937, what happened between the Japanese and the Chinese.
Right,
and
just the horrible... Yeah, Nanking. That was an utter massacre. The Japanese just came in and just wiped out.
You're talking about hundreds of thousands of people in a matter of weeks, Kevin.
Yeah.
And it was absolute brutality. When you reflect on what can happen, you realize what kind of existential commitments people do make to an ideal. So yeah, I think you're right, Kevin. We are watching these old men's dreams become disappointments.
Right.
Kevin, I think what you end up having in both of these instances is circumstantially a success. You know, you saw a ramp up in terms of the ECB and the EMU, and for 10 years, something you would say, how can you do this? How can you have the world's reserve currency, the US dollar, challenged by an upstart currency union that did not exist 10 years ago?
Right.
It just almost ex nihilo, there it is. That's pretty impressive, even though it is flawed, and we're finding now that it may be terminal. We find the same thing, Kevin, with our debt structure. What started out as perhaps a good idea, certainly functional, certainly something that you could do early on, and never was the question asked, should we do this? How will this end? How, if we go from 1 trillion to 3 to 4 to 5 to now 14, how will we ever shut it off? And that's where we're at today, Kevin. We have the makings of a Frankenstein.
You know, David, I was just thinking that. I was thinking when I was a little kid, we were visiting an aunt in Nebraska, so I was already in foreign surroundings, and everybody went to bed, and I was in her basement, and I saw Frankenstein on TV for the first time, And I'm telling you what, even telling you right now, it scared me because in the beginning, I didn't know what the story was. I had never heard it before. I was a little kid. And here he was creating a man out of other parts, a little bit like the European Union, creating something that was supposed to work together.
That was brilliant.
It was brutal at the end, though, Dave.
In the end.
It was brutal.
What's interesting, Kevin, is that this is not a modern concept. This is not something that on the basis of technology and innovation and globalization is a new idea. You can go back 3,000 years, and in Hebrew literature, you've got the idea of the golem.
The golem.
Which
That's
is
right.
the same thing as the Frankenstein monster. With our hands, we craft and create from clay something that life is breathed into, and then we lose control.
Right.
And so it's a theme that is repeated throughout history, and it's a theme that we've got to come to terms with. Debt is the issue. Structurally unsound fiscal policies are the issue. We have to address this systemically, and we have to do it very quickly, or this particular Frankenstein, Kevin, will not be controllable at all.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.